Hi, all. I'm Farah, alcoholic addict. My sister's here tonight. She's visiting. Yeah, and when she used to visit the Bay, she'd see me do stand-up wasted, so now she's seeing me talk sober. And my bit used to be queefing into the microphone, so she saw all sorts of Farah. And God grant me the serenity to not talk any more about queefing tonight. Okay, so I brought, like, scrapbook notes, because I do better with that. I want to talk about my spiritual experiences tonight. Instead of doing the drunkalogue, I want to talk about the spiritual salvation that's supposed to be the crux of the program. When I got sober, I got 5150 5 days sober, because I was cutting, I was doing other self-harm things, and I'm dual diagnosis, and my mental illness was unmanageable also. Because I had untreated alcoholism. I had gotten sober, and I didn't have the spiritual solution yet. I had a God-shaped hole that I couldn't fill with drink or drugs, and it was filled with nothing, and I was just crumbling. But since then, I've started getting the spiritual solution, and I want to share a quote from Many Paths to Spirituality. It's from the July 1965 Grapevine, and Bill W. says, "Let us not, therefore, pressure anyone with our individual or even our collective views. Let us instead accord each other the respect and love that is due to every human being as they try to make their way toward the light." And in the spirit of light and love, I want to share a prayer with y'all. It's one of my favorite prayers, and I honestly just want to give it to you guys. So here it goes. Oh God, place light in our hearts, and on our tongues light, and in our ears light, and in our sight, light, and above us, light, and below us, light, and to our right, light, and to our left, light, and before us, light, and behind us, light. Place in our souls, light. Magnify for us, light, and amplify for us, light. Make for us, light, and make us a light. O God, grant us light, and place light in our nerves, and in our bodies, light, and in our blood light, and in our hair light, and in our skin light. O God, make for us a light in our graves, and light in our bones. Increase us in light, increase us in light, increase us in light. Grant us light upon light. And I like this prayer because I think it's beautiful, and I like the imagery of light. But I think it's also a testament to how much we have to ask for God's help. It asks over and over and over and over again for light. And to me, I've been finding spiritual salvation slowly through asking constantly. And I first read this prayer the first and only time I've been to a mosque. I'm not Muslim, my dad is. But I went, and this is a prayer for when you enter a place of worship. You're supposed to, like, say it beforehand to prepare yourself. And I wrote it, and I whispered it, and I was, like, tearing up throughout it. And then when the call to prayer came on, it says, Allah, which means the God. The Allah means God. I broke down crying. And I felt fear in my heart. It was like my heart was trembling. And it was a fear of not myself. It was a fear of things greater than myself, which was a good feeling. It felt sort of like the fear I feel at the ocean, because the ocean terrifies me because it's fucking huge. And I found it, like, grounding. It made me feel mortal again. And the first time I felt this fear during my, like, spiritual journey in AA was the night before I quit using meth. And I'm trying to say I was fucking around with meth instead of I was using it, because it was using me. And I had a friend, an old friend, who is in AA now. And I knew them back in the day when I was doing stand-up here. Then they got sober. And they found out I was taking meth. And they said, we're going to a meeting. And the meeting was closed. So they came back to my room with me, my four walls. And they sat with me for hours as we both talked. And finally, with the comfort of having another alcoholic next to me, I was able to do a thought experiment I had been putting off through my using. I thought of my childhood self before me, and I asked myself what I was doing to them. And it was a little kid with long black hair. And when I asked myself this and imagined it, I broke down crying. And I felt this like big fear. It wasn't a voice in my head, but it was like I was being shook and being asked, like, what are you doing? And the best thing I could come up for like what I finally felt, because I hadn't felt scared the whole time. I felt like a little raccoon that wasn't afraid of anything. It was just like this little savage thing. But then finally I felt scared, and I felt like it was my conscience. And cut to later with my spiritual journey, I met this woman, Elisa, who she sat me down with the big book, and I had a spiritual experience from that. I started crying about how desperate myself was, how I was bodily and mentally different than my fellows, how I was helpless. And I kept telling Elisa, I was kind of talking about my conscience. I kept telling her, there's this little thing in me that's not the self, but it like it knows what's up, and it's like right, and it's not me, but it's like this little thing in me. And I thought she was gonna say like, no, everything about you is bad, but she was like, no, yeah, there's like a little thing in you, and you have to connect that to God. And she kept like putting her hands up from her tummy to the sky and saying like, just strengthen that connection and the self will slip away. And that night I went home to the big book and I was reading Spiritual Experience. I was reading earlier in the book and it had a footnote about Appendix 2. And I found in Appendix 2, it says, with few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. And I was like, oh my God, that's it. That's my conscience. That's the little thing inside me. So since then, I've been reading the big book with Elisa. I found a new sponsor who really gets me. I've started identifying with this little inner resource I have that looks like higher power. And maybe it is higher power. Maybe it's God consciousness. And instead of identifying with my thoughts and myself, which myself is like a robot, a little kid constructed, trying its best, and it's not serving me anymore, I've started identifying with this connection to higher power, and I'm ready for the self to slip away. And that's how I completed step 3 for the first time. I'm going to keep doing it. When you make a decision to turn your will over to the care of God as you understand God, it was the decision that I don't want myself anymore. I just want this connection with inner resource and higher power. And I drew a picture of it. I'll show y'all. This is the self on higher power. It's like a little flesh person. And then there's this little like star in its tummy connected to this like web of electric beauty. And the self doesn't matter. I'm still going to have these character defects and have to fix them and come back and do constant work. But the more I identify with God and the godness that might be inside me, this tiny inner resource. Hang on 1 minute. the more ready I am for the self to slip away. And it's a really beautiful thing, and it's sad too. Like, I cried reading with my friend Elisa because I was grieving myself, because it's going to go away and it's going to change and I don't want it anymore. My friend Elisa pointed out to me that AA is not a self-help program. Like Buddhism, some like forms of Buddhism or like artsy-fartsy shit can be self-help, but AA is like, it's like an overcoming the self program, it's a destruction of self program, it's a getting outside your self program. It's relying on powers that are greater than the self program. It's like not relying on yourself anymore. And that's what I needed in my whole fucking life, because I was trying to fix myself for 26 years. Until I found AA. So that's all I got. Thanks for listening.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dennis. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dennis.
Hey,
Dennis.
That was funny. I was asking Farah. I made a new friend, Farah, for the meeting, and Farah's awesome. And thank you, Farah. I appreciate what you had to say. And thanks to Cassie also for asking me to come share tonight. I really appreciate the opportunity. Sometimes when I secretary meetings, I ask people to come share, and I notice people show up with like their entourage or their posse or something like that. And then I was like getting ready to come here, I was like, oh, I don't have like a posse, I don't really have like an entourage or anything. But then I was thinking like, kind of AA is my posse, so it's like, I bet you when I get there, even though I've never been to this meeting before, I was like, I'll bet you when I get there, like, I'll know some people. And then, like, there's Justin and Richard, and then Catherine's here, and some other very familiar faces. So, yeah, you guys are like my posse, so thank you for being here. I'm going to not share too much of a drunkalogue, but because I got a lot of time to fill, you know, there may be some drunkenness in my story. I got a lot of good advice, you know, because I've never shared for this long. So, you know, one of the things I've learned in AA is one of the great things I've learned in AA is to, a couple things. One is to ask for help, you know, and so if I'm feeling uncomfortable or like I'm scared or I'm like nervous or I'm excited or I don't know exactly what to expect, like I can talk to people and get feedback from them. And that helps me also because, I don't know about how you guys are, but my lens sometimes that I see life through is a little bit distorted, so I don't always see things exactly as they are. So it's helpful to like talk to people, not just to get feedback from people, and then I can sort of get a sense of like, oh, okay, well this is, I can do this. So I asked some people tonight and about tonight, and my sponsor gave me some advice. He said, yeah, well, look at it this way. If, you know, if nobody in the meeting picks up a drink while you're sharing, then you call that a success. So I said, okay, I think, so I'm going to hold you guys to that. I'm going to keep my eye on you. And then today I went to a men's meeting that I go to on Saturday mornings and talked to my friend Dave, and he said, don't worry, Dennis, you're probably not going to break AA. So, you know, that, like, takes a little pressure off. You're not going to break AA. And then they, well, maybe people, he said, probably what you're going to say isn't that important. People, you know, in other words, people are going to, like, you know, it's going to be okay. So, anyway, that took a little pressure off. And then the most important one, the barista at Starbucks, and I do go to Starbucks. I'm not too embarrassed to say that. she said, how's your weekend going to be? I said, well, I got to speak in front of some people Saturday night. I'm a little nervous. I'm a little excited and nervous about that. And she's like, well, why don't you just, like, channel that nervousness and excitedness, just channel it, you know, into what you're saying. And I was like, yeah, see, smart. So here, my story starts very close to here. I'm a fourth generation Oakland native. I like to say I'm an Oakland native. I'm not actually. I grew up in Piedmont, which some of you guys know where that is. A little village up here, very close to here, up on the hill. And yeah, it's interesting because we all had our childhood experiences. Piedmont's a pretty great place to grow up in the sense that it's very safe, super safe. And very affluent, and I didn't come from a broken family. I came from a mom and a dad, and I'm the oldest of four siblings. There were actually three of us when I was growing up, and then a fourth one kind of like came along a little bit later. But, you know, by all outward appearances, I had every advantage, you know, growing up, and it was really a good life, good schools, good friends, good people, and the one thing I did experience, though, is that I had this feeling of not really fitting in too much when I was growing up, and I've heard other people share that same feeling. So I think a lot of the experiences I had are somewhat universal. I tended to have a lot of different friends, but I never had people over to my house. I was always going to other people's houses, and I would develop these really quick friendships. It would be really intense. Like, I'd hang out with people every single day for like the whole summer, and then I don't know what would happen, but it would like just end. And then I'd find someone new. And so I think it was like an early form. This was before I ever started drinking and using, but it was like an early form of like just wanting to escape and wanting to get out of my household environment. And I did mention, I mean, my house was good. My home was good. Everything looked good, but my father was an alcoholic. That's a shocker, I know, but he was an alcoholic, very high-functioning alcoholic. He ran his own business, as I do myself now. I also run my own business, and he drank a lot, and he escaped a lot into his work, so he was just like the sort of I'm going to go work and make some money. I'm too busy to sort of hang out with the kids type thing. And my mom, she was really young, and she was sort of depressed, and she was a little bit overwhelmed. And she had three kids that were all really close together in age. The first three of us, my sister was born less than a year after I was born. So if you do the math, that's a pretty aggressive timetable. And then my next brother came along about 18 months later. So there were three of us that were only 30 months apart. And my mom was 22 when I was born, which when I think of it now, like 22 is pretty young. And she was also from Bellingham, Washington. So she just, my dad kind of like, didn't kidnap her, but you know, whatever people do, it's like just moved her down here. So she's like out of her element. She started like producing kids right away. She's 22 years old. And I think she was just really, she was doing the best she can, you know, with the tools that she had. So, you know, I was doing the best I could to function. The other thing that never happened in our house, and I don't know how it was for any of you guys, I hear a lot of stories about people that grew up with a lot of rage in their household, a lot of anger, you know, fathers they were really afraid of, you know, what's going to happen with if the belt comes out, I'm going to get whipped. Yeah, it wasn't my experience. Our house was like, there was no emotions. Feelings were not not really discussed very much. Everything was to be okay. Everything was to be kept on a very even plane. You weren't supposed to get upset. Never allowed to get angry. So that's something I've had to work on in sobriety now. I carry my little feeling words with me now, like how I really feel, you know? And sometimes I do get angry, you know? I get angry. But growing up, no, we weren't allowed to get angry. And the parents never got angry, except sometimes it would just like come out in these big bursts. And it was like, I remember once my mom threw she had like a Vogue magazine or something. I don't know what we were talking about. She just like winged it at me as hard as she could from across the kitchen. All the pages kind of flayed out, and it was like, I was probably like 8 or 9 years old, and like I still really remember that. So, you know, again, feelings weren't good. Kind of the eggshell thing, you know, you're kind of walking on eggshells, you're just trying to stay everything in line, just trying to like survive. And like a lot of people have described before, I had this really feeling of like, not having the owner's manual to life, like how to sort of navigate through stuff. And it was just really challenging, you know. And I the other thing I couldn't do was I couldn't speak up for myself very well. It's like I just, you get shut down a lot if you try to like say what you're not happy about or what you need. It just, those weren't really good conversations to have with the parents. Because my dad wasn't around that much. My mom was kind of overwhelmed just trying to get by. So I figured out that I could get what I want through manipulation, cheating, stealing, lying, with the best of intentions. But it was like the end around. So one of my early experiences was my mom at some point, this was in the, I don't want to say exactly how old I am, but let's just say it was the 70s. And my mom was in the first wave of like health food, you know, whatever. God knows what it was back then, but it was some kind of health food. And I'm a kid and I want like candy or something. And it was like, there wasn't none of that happening. So we used to have a Safeway up the street from where I lived on Highland Avenue in Piedmont. And I went up and decided to do a little shoplifting. And I was probably like 9 years old. This was before I picked up the first drink. Ever picked up a drink, and I went there, and this is kind of telling. I grabbed the candy bar. I this is like not good shoplifting, because I was like, I loitered for a long time in front of the candy, kind of thinking about it, kind of mulling it over, walk away, you know, it's just probably like really bad idea. And so then finally I get the candy bar, and that thought was immediately followed with, I better get more candy bars. So I was wearing this big puffy down jacket. I grabbed a bunch of candy bars and I started filling, you know, I had a lot of pockets and I filled them all up, and it's like, all right. And so then I headed for the exit, and then I felt the big hand of doom on my shoulder. And I was like, oh. But I always remember that just because it was like, it really spoke to, and there was no consequences, by the way. I think like I lived three doors from Safeway, so they like walked me home. And I don't remember like getting yelled at by my parents or anything, but you know, it's that like not being able, a lot of us had that, you know, it's like I couldn't speak up for what I wanted and what I, like having my needs met. And I think wanting a little bit of candy when you're 9 years old isn't totally unreasonable, but I just couldn't have that conversation, so I had to manipulate. And that really was a pattern that has followed me a lot of my life, you know, just trying to get what I need through, I don't like to call it like passive aggressive, but just through sort of like, and they talk about that in the big book too, you know, they talk about people running the show and trying to arrange the pieces and becoming, I would be the gracious type, like more and more gracious every time, but deep down inside, like I'm not getting, you know, I'd be gracious, but I'm always trying to sort of get my way and not really be direct. And, you know, that ended up ultimately not serving me too well. So, lo and behold, I'll get drunk and then I'll get sober for you. I'll get sober twice. This would be really exciting. I found some friends. This uncomfortable feeling continued. And what happened was, around the age of 12 or 13, like a lot of us, I started hanging out with some bad kids. You know, I told you I'd jump around from kid to kid. And I had a friend named Clark, and then he had these two friends named Ron and James, and like, I like these guys, something about these guys. They seem a little bit dangerous, but I could really relate to them. And this guy, Clark, you know, he's a pretty good kid, and he warned me once. It was like that, kind of like that ominous warning that you don't heed. And he's like, they're really nice guys, but I'd be really careful about hanging out with them too much. And I, okay, whatever, I'm going to go hang out with these guys. And so we got into, we vandalized the local elementary school, we stole stuff, and one time I was over at James's house, and he opened this little trap door in his dining room floor, and there was wine bottles down there, and he brought up some wine bottles, and we started drinking, and something clicked. I thought, this is a really great idea. We were drinking, and then I thought, well, my dad's got champagne, so the next time we went to drink, I stole champagne from my dad's basement. And my experience with drinking was, it made me feel more comfortable, gave me a feeling of like comfort and ease, you know, that I'd never felt before. I always felt uncomfortable. I was able to speak up for myself a little bit better. And also, like a lot of us, I really gravitated towards a set of friends. You know, I found like these two guys. By the way, little fun fact, Ron, one of those two guys, he wrapped his car around a telephone pole at Russian River when he was in his 20s and he died. James, I ran into 20 years later. He's clean and sober and an active member of AA here in the East Bay. So, you know, many of the people I hung out with, not all of them, but many of them are either sober or dead at this point, or maybe incarcerated, something like that. So I'm going to spare you the part from like 13 to 25, because my story was pretty regular. There was a lot of drinking. I was a daily, I'll just be honest, this is my story. I was a daily pot smoker from the age of 13 through 25. And also, in my early teenage years, between the age of 13 and 16, I experimented quite a bit with psychedelic mushrooms and LSD. And for the kids out there, I'm not recommending that at all. It's not good for the developing mind. But that was my experience. I left high school when I was 15 years old. I tested my way out. I went to junior college. At Merritt College here in Oakland. I went to the University of Oregon, so I was still functioning pretty good, even though I was getting drunk and high all the time. But I still, this thing of not fitting in, I would always find the people that drank, and the people that drank and used like I did. But I just never fit in. I graduated college when I was like 20 years old. I thought there was like this race in life. I thought I was going to win at the game of life by finishing school early. And that was a little disappointing to find out it didn't really come to pass. It really isn't a race. And, you know, I'm learning more now than I did probably, you know, when I was young. I graduated. All my family had moved out of the Bay Area by then. They all moved up to Oregon. They all live, my brother and sister still live up in Eugene. And I came right back down to the Bay Area. I graduated within 2 weeks. I'm back down here on the 4th of July. I'm back down in the Bay Area. found a job, and started drinking and partying. I found all my old friends, which is what we do, and I added in one extra ingredient, which was one of my friend's dad was a cocaine dealer over in San Francisco at the corner. He had a Victorian apartment at the corner of California and Steiner Street, and so I got involved with the cocaine. I'm also not recommending that, but what it did for me was it accelerated my decline, and eventually, by the time I was 25, the alcohol, the cocaine and alcohol use was so bad that I could barely show up for work. It would be 3 in the morning. I would still be up 4 in the morning. And I got to where it's like, well, if I just get 2 hours of sleep, and it was just a miserable, miserable existence. And I only share that because I try to still remember what that was really like. And what happened was I got a big check at work. I got a commission check. I got a $6,000 check, and I was 25 years old. And I got scared to death that I was going to kill myself because I would have an unlimited drug and alcohol budget and many bad things could happen. So I don't know how I knew about AA, but what happened was that I think I heard like a public service announcement or some story on the radio, or I don't know. I didn't know anyone in AA. I knew nothing about AA. I went to a phone book. I looked up AA, and they gave me the address for the Island Fellowship in Alameda. And I always joke about this. I thought maybe that was AA for like Northern California. I had no way of knowing. I was just like really scared. And so I was just really bad. And so I went to the Island Fellowship. That was February 7th of 1988, and I put down the alcohol, I put down the drugs, and I sobered up that very first day, February 7th, 1988. And it was like I kind of found like a whole new set of people. And I let go of all my drinking and using friends. I got involved in the fellowship. I secretaried meetings. I got a sponsor. His name was Little Lloyd E. or Lloyd Ellis, little bald-headed guy who's since passed away. And you know, it really changed my life for the better. The thing is, I wasn't too keen on working the steps because it seemed like there'd be a lot of feelings involved. It seemed like scary. I just wanted to avoid that. So I didn't, and I hoped maybe I had like alcoholism light and I could just skate by on the fellowship, you know, regular meeting attendance, service, fellowship. And eventually what happened was I decided I wanted to be, and I still want to be this, but I want to be just cool non-drinking guy. Because it'd be really nice, or cool non-drinking gal in some of your cases, but because wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have to like do all the stuff we have to do, if we could just be like, yeah, I just don't drink. It'd be great, right? And I've always been one of these guys, if I get a little separation from the drugs and alcohol, I'm not a strong, like, I'm not a big craving guy. Like, I don't have this immediate urge. Like, I don't have these really strong compulsions. So I'm thinking, like, I'm good, right? I think I'm good. So then I got my checklist. I said, well, what do I need to do now? I'm 26 at this time. I got, you know, a lot of sobriety. By this time, I've been, like, sober for, like, 9 or 10 months, maybe a year. And so I'm like, okay, I got to get married. I got to get a girlfriend first. I got to find a girl. I got to get married. I got to have some kids. I got to start a business. I got to buy a house. I had a lot on my checklist. So I started doing it. And I met a gal. I went to a swimming class. And there was all these girls in the pool. And like the third one, I tried to ask out. She said yes. And I was like, so, okay, I'll take you. And which is kind of sad. But I mean, that's really the way in my mind sometimes will still tend to function. But that's a different story. So she was a fine young woman. She was actually 8 years older than me, but just great, great woman. And she liked me, and we got married, and we moved to Fremont. And I didn't know anything about Freehold. We lived in a condo in Fremont on Paseo Padre Parkway. And I just stopped going to AA. By this time, I was super sober because I was like, I was probably like 16 or 17 months. And I'm totally good. So I embarked upon Cool Non-Drinking Guy. We got married. We bought a house right away back up here in Oakland, up in the Glenview. She got pregnant. It was a little bit of, you know, she wasn't, didn't easily, she got pregnant. We had a kid. I started a business. I was winning. I was literally winning at the game of life. It was so exhilarating. Had a second kid. But here's the thing, guys, is that without a fellowship, without a recovery program, and without the steps or the tools we get from having worked the steps, life started just kind of pile up on me. So I got all the outward things going, but people started dying on me. My grandpa died, my grandma died, and in my family, people died. It was just like, oh, bad news, grandpa died, and then it's like, that's it. You know, you just go on. There's no, like, getting sad, or there's no, like, memorials. There's no funerals, so you just kind of cram it down inside, and, you know, you keep going. And then my dad got the Alzheimer's. I don't recommend that. He got it when he was 58 years old, and he was dead by the time he was 66, and he was a brilliant man, too. And that was really, really hard on me. And the whole situation, my parents had divorced by then. A lot of things were just not really good. And shortly before he died, you know, this had been going on, and I was the executor, and everyone was arguing, and it was my uncle, and it was just, it's like a nightmarish time in my life. But I'm still sober. By this time, it's 2001, and I hadn't had a drink in, 13 years? So, you know, I was good, but I was just not coping too well with life. And I don't know if this bothered anyone else, but the September 11th terrorist attacks also had a big impact on me. I felt unsafe, you know, because of that. But I didn't know how to express that. I just was shoving stuff down, just kept shoving it down. And then my dad died. Eventually, things just started to fall apart on me. My business wasn't doing well. My marriage wasn't going well. I couldn't speak up for myself in my marriage. My wife at the time was abusive towards my kids, and I didn't know how to advocate for them. So I just did what my dad used to do. Well, I'm going to go to work. You know, I'll be home at 9:30 tonight. You know, something like that. And I try and get home and get to bed, you know, without having to deal with stuff. And it just piled up so bad. One day I just walked out. I walked out on the marriage. My daughters were 12 and 6 years old at that time, and I just couldn't take it anymore. I just walked out. What happened after that was, I'm not going to tell the whole story, but basically I got remarried to a Chinese massage therapist who I had met at, you know, at a massage parlor, and I thought that would be a great idea because she seemed to really like me. So I got married to her, and we had another child together. So I have a third daughter, her name is Sabrina, who I now single parent, so she lives with me. So I've had some great blessings with my daughters. They've actually all turned out to be amazing people. I also get along with both. Oh, she's also an ex-wife, by the way, now, and I get along very well with both my ex-wives, and all three of my daughters are great blessings. But things started to pile up on me, and the reason I know I'm an alcoholic is sometime around 2010, my problems had gotten so bad that it occurred to me that taking a drink would be a really good idea, because that's going to take a little of this, I mean, the pressure at this point was just starting to just wear. You know, I was still trying to get along with the first wife, do things with that family, go to church, and I've got the massage therapist wife who doesn't hardly speak a whole lot of English, and I've got this other daughter. I'm bringing my baby to church with me, and like, who's that? You know, and it was a big problem. So I tried drinking again. And that was in 2010, and my experience was horrible. by this time, my Chinese girlfriend, or Chinese wife, had a Chinese boyfriend, and I started engaging in stalking behaviors. I took little baseball bats and wrapped them with tape, and I would like carry them around. And I was like, I never hurt anybody, and I never really, but I was just, it was just a very insane like stalking behavior. Insanely drunk, my little girl who was 4 years old, I'd wait till she fell asleep. I'd put her in the car seat in my old Volvo wagon, and then I'd get a 12-pack of beer, and I'd go go around where I thought my wife would be with her boyfriend, so I could look through the crack, and it was just really sad. And it just didn't work. You know, I needed a solution. I needed some relief, and that unfortunately didn't work too well for me. So, on November 4th, 2011, after a little over a year of trying the drinking experiment, and it went just so horribly wrong, I came back to AA. I came back to the Island Fellowship, the same place I went in 1988. And there were dudes at that meeting that had also been there in 1988. And then the little light bulb came on, you know, ding, they're sober 20 plus, 30 plus years, and they're still attending meetings, they're still showing up, they're still sharing their experience. And it's like, oh yeah, that would have been a really good idea, was to do that. I just didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't want to do the hard work of doing the steps. So when I came back, about my fourth day sober, I'm at Central Office, not the original Central Office, not the new Central Office, but the one on 27th. And fourth day sober, I'm walking out of the meeting, and some guy comes out, again, it's the hand on the shoulder, and he's like, ah, what's this going to be? And it was this guy, and he's like, hey, you need a sponsor? And I'm like, yeah, I do, probably. And so, actually, I said, I'll think about it. So I went down to the Island Fellowship. I asked some of these guys, and I said, this guy wants to sponsor me, but he's African. He's like a Muslim. He's like 20 years younger than me. I don't think we have much in common. Like, do you think it's okay? And they're like, yeah, it's probably a really good idea. So if he's willing to sponsor you, they said you should take advantage of that. So he took me through the steps. And that's what's really changed my life a lot, is going through the steps. And like Farah talked about, you know, having, I like the idea that the whole point of going through the steps is that we can find a relationship with a power greater than ourselves. And in the best of times now, having gone through these steps, I get these feelings of comfort and ease, you know, that I used to try and get through drugs and alcohol. And when I do get them, you know, it's a great thing, and there's no hangover from it or anything like that. So he took me through the steps. I did all the steps. I did them in order. I did them as instructed, using Hazelden pamphlets. And I asked him, well, why are we using Hazelden pamphlets? He says, because he went through the steps in San Francisco with his sponsor, and they used Hazelden pamphlets. So I'm like, okay, well, I guess we're going to use the Hazelden pamphlets. And it worked, you know. And it's like, I'm always one of these guys who feels like, kind of a perfectionist. I mean, I'm one of these people that feels like I'm not doing AA well enough. I'm not as good, you know. I'm not like as sober as Justin is, or, you know, or whatever, you know, or anybody, or Richard, for that matter. But it's like, I'm trying to get over that now. It's like, it's to a point where I'm a big believer that, you know, in the 24-hour program, you know, we have this daily reprieve. I try and go to sleep sober. I wake up sober, and I try and navigate through the day, staying present in the moment and using these tools we have that we're given. And I use pretty much all of them now. So real quick, I have gone through three sponsors in 7 years, 7.5 years. The first sponsor, God bless him, he moved away from AA and got into a food recovery program. So that just didn't serve my needs anymore, because we would talk about, like, how about those Warriors? And he just, you know, we would just talk about sports and stuff. And so that was good for a while, so I could kind of coast and not really do any work. But I eventually changed sponsors, and that sponsor was super helpful in really about the spiritual, really, really into the spirituality of things. And we never worked steps, but the steps were sort of applied to life situations, which is really helpful. And then he fired me right around Christmas time last year, which was super sad. I'm not sure why, but he let me go, and so I started working with a new sponsor. And I try to stay engaged in the steps now. You know, I try and apply the steps. I try and practice the 10th, 11th, and 12th step. If someone like Cassie asked me to, if someone comes to ask me to share, like, I'll come share. I do service. I'm going to share this with you. This is why I like to stay engaged in the steps. So my new sponsor, he got sober when he was 19, and he's, like, almost as old as me. So he's been sober for, like, ever. And he's, like, a very common sense, you know, not very, like, emotional kind of guy. He's just very, like, kind of common sense. And so he's like, well, I want to take you through the steps again. I was like, all right. So he did this little exercise with me, which is really good. And he's like, after a while, you know, we're meeting, and he says, make a list of things you're powerless over. And then in one column, then the other column, how does that make your life unmanageable? Okay, so, you know, in usual fashion, I kind of procrastinate, and I write a few things down, you know, right before we're going to meet, you know. And it's like, a lot of the things I came up with weren't actually things. They were like my own sort of, I personally don't like character defects, but they're some like my own defense mechanisms. They're not things. They're just like traits that I have that cause me problems. He's like, no, things. And he's like, also, I noticed you didn't put alcohol on the list. He says, that's kind of interesting. So he sent me back to the drawing board. So I spent another week, and then he was out of town. So it ends up being 2 weeks. And I finally call the guy. It's like, this is like really embarrassing to say, but it's like, I'm having trouble coming up with things that I'm powerless. And the few things I can think of, I honestly can't see how they're making my life unmanageable. And I said, that honestly, that kind of scares the crap out of me, because that feels like that sort of hard candy shell of pride that I'm prone to getting, where I kind of like, yeah, everything's fine, right? Everything's good. And I was like, but I was honest about it. I mean, I said it out loud to him. I said, it kind of scares me. And I came up with some more stuff. We met. And he said, well, I just want you to observe over the next couple of weeks. Just observe. You know, don't do anything. Just observe. And, you know, I like to say God, as I understand him, has kind of a twisted sense of humor. The last couple of weeks have just been one thing after another that I'm completely powerless over. My beautiful brand new car. I went to Everett and Jones Barbecue down at 2nd and Broadway. And then all the windows got smashed, and they stole something out of it. My second wife took my daughter out of town to Reno for the weekend with, like, no advance notice on Friday, right before I got my window smashed, which I thought made me confused and uncomfortable, but it actually made me angry once I thought about it. It's like, that kind of made me mad. It's like, you know, tell me what's going on. I had an employee issue. I had someone at work that I had to let go who'd been with me for 17 years. That's really hard things to do, really, really hard. And he's one of us, and he's in relapse right now, and there's nothing I can really do to help him. And he's been sending threatening text messages to other former employees, and every time I hear about one of those, and it's like, I'm kind of powerless over that. I can't. And so it's humbling to see that being sober, I'm still powerless. There's still a lot of things I'm powerless over, and I need the program. I need this fellowship. I need, I need all of you guys. I need the steps. I need sponsorship. But the good news is I have an amazing life, you know. And right now, I'm going to wrap things up here pretty quick because we're running short on time. So what I do today is I try and stay actively engaged with a sponsor. I have the good fortune to be sponsoring someone right now. I just heard his fifth step about a week or two ago. He's doing really, really well. He's like 7 months sober now. So for me, as a recovering alcoholic, if I have a sponsor and I'm sponsoring someone, it's a really nice space to be in. I feel sort of sort of supported and sort of, you know, I feel really well balanced to be getting support from my sponsor and to be able to share with someone newer than myself. The other thing that's been coming up a lot lately, in addition to honesty and a little bit of humility with regard to the first and the second step, is trust. You know, it's just the something I'm going to leave you guys with is a little bit of thought. It's always been hard for me to trust people. You know, this comes from my childhood, and it's something I'm really working on a lot now. I do a lot of self-care stuff now. I do CrossFit training. I do sports massage. I do yoga. I have a therapist. You know, I have a lot of people I get support from. And I was getting this massage, and this woman is like, it's like painful, but it's so good afterwards. And then she's doing this thing with my neck, and I was like, and you know, and usually she's like, well, you just need to like melt or something. I'm like, well, I don't know what that means, melt. And then all of a sudden she said, she's doing this thing, and she said, trust, or she said, basically said something like trust me. And all of a sudden, like, I thought my neck's going to snap, or I'm going to be paralyzed for life. And it was like, and then I, all of a sudden, like, I let go, and she's like, she just says to me, like, you've got trust issues. And it was like, I started crying, because it's like, wow, you know. But like, today I'm open to hear that kind of stuff, and it's like, that was like really liberating. It's like, wow, this is like really cool stuff. So I love AA. I'm glad to be a part of AA. I want to always keep learning. I want to stay humble. And I'm just really glad to be a part of this thing. And I was able to talk for almost 40 minutes.
Thanks.
I could talk for like another hour if you guys. Anyway, thank you guys very much. Appreciate it.